Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi, the streaming online cinema. For your free 30-day trial of Mubi, go to mubi.com/filmstage.
If you having girl problems, I feel bad for you, son. I got 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one. I got the rap patrol on the cat patrol. Foes that want to make sure my cask is closed. Rap critics to save money, cash holes. I'm from the hood, stupid. What type of facts are those? If you grew up with holes in your zap with toes, you celebrate the minute you was having dope. I'm like, fuck critics, you can kiss my whole asshole. If you don't like my lyrics, you can press fast forward. Got beef with radio.
Back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the movie review podcast for thefilmstage.com. I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, and with me today to talk about The Beguiled, we have Michael Snydell.
Good morning. Hello.
We also have Bill Graham.
Woo!
And we are here this day after 4th of July, Independence Day, to talk about the Civil War era thriller psychodrama The Beguiled from director Sofia Coppola, starring Nicole Kidman, Kirsten Dunst, Elle Fanning, and Colin Farrell, amongst many others. Before we get into that, some housekeeping as usual. We can follow us on Twitter at Film Stage Show. You can also find us on the Facebook, search for The Film Stage Show. And, of course, you can give us a comment or reading on iTunes or email us podcast@thefilmstage.com. In addition to that, I would just like to remind everyone that we currently have a Patreon going. So if you would like to help this show do even more and be even more than it already is, all you got to do is go to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. And give as little as $1 per episode to help us reach our goals so that we can produce new and interesting content and get better equipment and generally make this whole shindig financially feasible for us. Again, that is patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. And giving as little as $1, you will already be entered into winning fabulous prizes that we steal from Jordan Raup. And, of course, you will get an access to our Slack channel, so you can talk to us live and in person in real time. And if those aren't reasons enough to do it, I just don't know what to tell you. So again, that is patreon.com/thefilmstageshow to become a patron and help us do more cool shit. In addition to that, thank you, Bill. In addition to that, we are brought to you by Mubi, the streaming online cinema. Mubi is different than other streaming platforms because Mubi has curators who hand select each film that they put out. Every day they add a new film and you have 30 days to watch, so there's a constantly rotating selection of 30 films for your viewing enjoyment. Michael Snydell is here for other reasons, but also to talk about one of the movies that has just been added to Mubi, and that is The Happiest Day in the Life of Ali Mackey. Michael Snydell, why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So I reviewed this movie last year at a local film festival, and it is a biopic about a boxer. There've certainly been a few of those, but what I really like about it is that it is very much about his struggle with fame, but not necessarily in trying to overcome the odds or like trying to become the greatest, but literally how even the possibility of being known and like becoming something greater, like how that, you know, really kind of racks his psyche. And it's really interesting in that it's a gorgeous film shot in black and white. And I can't say I've seen a lot of Finnish movies, but this is kind of a real highlight, and it's available on Mubi. So I would say check it out.
All right. Excellent. And yes, that is now streaming exclusively on Mubi. So for your free trial, go to mubi.com/filmstage, and you will have a free 30-day trial of Mubi so that you too can understand the wonder that is a perfectly curated selection of films constantly rotating and available on all your streaming devices. Any other thoughts or things that we wanted to talk about before we jumped into our main review, gentlemen?
Nope.
I don't think so. I just want to say that Our Slack channel is becoming a very healthy conversation hub. Yes. And it's pretty cool to go back on there and, you know, like, you will see people are talking about literally everything.
It is quite amazing. Yes. So to everyone who's listening, who's a part of that, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And I'd like to say to the gentleman on Twitter who created a poll, and I'm gonna pull it up now so that I can be absolutely certain that I have the wording of this correct.
I can tell you verbatim, probably off the top of my head, which film is Brian J. Rowan the most wrong about?
Yeah, it's from Jacob Seaver. What movie is at Brian J. Rowan most wrong about? The options were Queen of Earth, Baby Driver, and 999. That poll has since ended, and for anyone who's interested, Baby Driver won with 46% of the vote. That's the one I voted for.
999 is the answer. 999 is definitely the answer.
I was telling my wife about this because she also loves 999. I'm like, you know, I'm just happy that 999 is losing, because that means that of all the people who looked at this poll, a majority of them said at least he is not the most wrong about that movie. And since I was, like, emphatically in love with that movie, that means that those people must think that movie is basically okay. So,
Brian,
good work,
if we ever meet in person, my girlfriend and I hated 999. Your wife and you love 999. We're going to have to talk about 999.
Oh, my God. What a zany adventure that will be.
It's no.
Cats
no.
and dogs right there.
No. No.
And we'll record it for the good people.
Just like a whole night of you and your girlfriend and me and my wife getting, like, progressively more drunk and angry at each other as we shout about 999.
Boy.
It'll be like, who's
this
afraid
is the
of
worst
Virginia yet. Woolf?
Yep. That's the exact reference that's going to make.
All right. Well, hey, if we get to a certain amount of money pledged per episode, maybe we can afford to, like, meet somewhere and do that, and that will be a special episode.
And then we'll take it off Broadway.
Yeah, it'll be great. Anyway, all of our patrons, thank you so much, and I hope you're enjoying the Slack channel as much as we are. Jacob Sever, I can't remember. You know, I respect the shit out of you for tagging me in that poll, and I get it. I really do. I also loved all the people who were like, why is La La Land not on this list? Why is Moonlight not on this list? It's like, apparently, I'm an iconoclast. What can I say? Anyway, so let's talk about The Beguiled. Again, this is the newest film from director Sofia Coppola, who has done Marie Antoinette and The Virgin Suicides, as well as Lost in Translation, and many others. This movie stars Nicole Kidman, Elle Fanning, Kirsten Dunst, Nicole Kidman, Una Lawrence, who you may remember from Pete's Dragon, and Gori Rice, who you may remember from The Nice Guys.
But probably won't see in this movie.
Okay, yeah, we'll talk about, like, who gets the short shrift in this film, but you definitely at least see Anne Gori Rice, like, more than Emma Howard.
Sure, I'm not sure who that is, but yes.
My wife and I were talking about this movie, and she was like, and then there was the other girl, and I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? And then she was right. Anyway, getting ahead of ourselves, here, for your listening pleasure, is the trailer.
We ask for your protection over our school, and we pray that we will be kept from harm throughout the night.
Amen.
Miss Martha! Miss Martha!
Is he dead?
No. Get him inside. Quick! You're a most unwelcome visitor, and we do not propose to entertain you.
You'll find them easily amused.
You won't be here long enough for that.
How did you end up in this place?
Why are you so interested in me?
I admire your strength.
I'm just trying to give them.
All right, that is the trailer for The Beguiled. This movie stars Colin Farrell as a Union soldier who is wounded during a battle during the Civil War, and who is found by a young girl in the forest who leads him back to the Farnsworth Seminary for Young Women, where he and the five students and one teacher and one headmistress find themselves trapped in a cauldron of ever-increasing tension. Let's talk about this movie. So, let's start off with Michael Sneidel. Michael Sneidel, what did you think of The Beguiled?
Sure. So Sofia Coppola's is a little bit of a hit and miss, especially lately for me. I didn't really like The Bling Ring, and I can't remember the one before that. Sorry, guys. And her Bill Murray Christmas was really bad, and I need to get that on the record. So, this is very much in line with the rest of her movies, like in the sense that her movies are often about, she's like made a career of like withholding emotion and, you know, movies that kind of soak in atmosphere and are as much about what isn't said as what is said. This is a really interesting movie, but I'm not sure I'd find it nearly as interesting if I didn't also watch the original, I think it's 1976, The Beguiled by Don Siegel. And I think they're really interesting in the sense that like one is very much like narrative logic. One is very much emotional logic. One is very much about like desire, and one is very much about duty. And so there is something very interesting to be said for a lot of little things in Coppola's Beguiled. I think this very much feels like a deliberate revision and like cutting down of a story that, even if you haven't seen the original, there are going to be some things where you might be scratching your head about motives that move beyond like, I'm going to guess this person's like intuitive logic here. So I guess that would technically be fine. I have no problem with movies that want to skirt over linear narrative. But it becomes more of a problem for me when the first act of this movie very much works in that way, where it is like you're supposed to glean much from, like, you know, lines that could very easily be double entendres, in the sense of like words like comfort, which can take on two very different connotations. Sure. But as it goes on, it then has to meet with the plot. And once it meets with the plot, it starts requiring characters to jump and things to move in a way that just feels very awkward to me. And I feel it kind of loses the point and loses the characters and the interesting ideas that they build. Like, I love like a lot of little things. I love, for instance, that this is shot in muted natural lighting, to the point where I wondered whether my projection was like incorrect. I love that there is this movie so unconcerned with the war and is so much more like interested in just like how this group of women, how they like slowly start dressing up, or how they keep looking for any opening possible to talk to Colin Farrell's character in this, who's almost like too sexy in this movie. I love the female gaze on him and everything, but there's something where I think it's kind of a misstep that even the moments at like even a glimpse of his possible nature is just like weighted with so much ambiguity. And I feel like ultimately I understand what she's going for, but I think this movie just needed to fucking pick a decision about where to go. And it doesn't really do so. And the last interesting thing about this is kind of a surprisingly like ruthlessly efficient movie in terms of narrative and things. But I do think it's very interesting that she was kind of able to communicate this atmosphere of a much more like languid, like sometimes or you know, something akin to something like, you know, Barry Lyndon or Age of Innocence, like something that's very languid and, you know, feels like you're spending a lot of time with it. So that is one kind of cool thing. But my final thought is just that I just don't think it quite works. I think it's more of an experiment. And for all the moments that I think are kind of an interesting subversion of what could have been a more straight ahead story, it just ends up being kind of wispy and a little bit hollow.
All right. Bill Graham, what did you think of The Beguiled?
So kind of going off of one of the last few things that Michael said there, I do agree that Colin Farrell is perhaps a little too pretty in this film. From what I had heard, Chris Hemsworth was originally kind of eyed for this role, and I think he would have been ogled. I think he would have been fantastic in this role, and I hate to insert that this soon into this discussion, but I just want to mention that we've seen creepy out of Colin Farrell before. We've seen that kind of insidious kind of look. I don't think we've gotten that from Chris Hemsworth yet, and I think that would have been a really nice change of pace, because what this film really requires from our main character is to both be likable and for us to be on his side for the most part. And I think the film still does a very good job of that, but it also doesn't allow Colin Farrell to really chase after these women in the way that I feel like it's trying to subject us to. It almost feels like it's reined in a little bit, and I'm not sure for whose benefit that is. I don't necessarily think it benefits the narrative. I don't think it necessarily benefits the film overall. I think it's detrimental to not let Colin Farrell really kind of have his way in a lot of ways. He gets away with a lot, but it's too little too late for the most part, I think.
Bill, I just want to interject real quick. Clint Eastwood, from literally the first moment he's seen on screen in the original, is just kind of a lusty brute. And it's the movie is immensely helped by that. So I know they're two different movies, but just as a point of contrast, I did want to mention that.
Sure. You know, one thing that I had kind of expected from this film early on was a lot of mood and a lot of tension. And Sophia definitely gives us a lot of that. I haven't liked Nicole Kidman's performances very often lately. I feel like she's been a little underutilized in a lot of things. She is fantastic here. Her screen presence is everything that I wanted out of that character, everything that I wanted out of Kidman overall within the last, decade or so that we just haven't gotten. She has just this icy kind of look to her and demeanor throughout this entire film. And she gives some smiles, some knowing smiles and some knowing kind of winks and nods and looks that are just utterly perfect. And so I just really want to kind of give her a big, round of applause, because she's fantastic throughout this entire movie. And I wished we had spent more time kind of from her perspective. We often see her mainly dealing with Colin Farrell's character, in person, but we don't very often see her outside of even that room. I do want to mention they keep him in kind of like it's their music practice room is what it's being used as, right before he comes. But like, it's just a wing right off from the main entry. And so every interaction that they have is always like, and it's right next to the staircase as well. So he is like at a location where every action, every like big sequence of event, anything that happens in that house, like it all seems to kind of be focused right outside of that door in some way. And I love that kind of setup, the way the house kind of just keeps highlighting his presence there, you know, whether they're locking the door and things like that. And he can always hear things going on outside. So the comings and goings of the women inside the house is fantastic. And kind of to start to wrap this up a little bit, because I think I've been rambling a little bit too much. I think this film really doesn't know where it necessarily wants to land. I think it tries really hard at kind of setting a mood and an expectation that it never really follows through with. I found myself entertained throughout the entire film, but I didn't find myself as satisfied as I wanted to be from the narrative as a whole. And I'm not sure where that blame lies beyond. I just wanted it to go a little bit crazier, and I can kind of touch on some of those things further in spoilers. Everybody's doing a great job. I love that she subtly adds explosions and booms in the background, and they start to slowly fade as the film goes on. And that kind of plays into the narrative and things like that. But it is interesting that you can basically hear the war going on in the background anytime there's like an exterior sequence. And I was also troubled by the way it was kind of shot. I thought it was a little hazy. So, but it is what it is. It's a choice. So overall, I think I enjoyed it, but I'm hesitant to give it a full recommendation.
Yes. So I agree with all of you. Insofar as I like really loved the first 2/3 to 3/4 of this movie.
Agreed.
Yeah. I thought that it was an excellent exercise in tension building and like atmosphere. First of all, I need to talk about this, because like I think that if you have a problem with Colin Farrell being too pretty in this movie, Chris fucking Hemsworth would like break you in half. Because
I understand like, yes, like his prettiness is ridiculous, but I like I said, I just think we haven't seen him play creepy, and I just really want to see someone play against kind of type in this role.
So here, one of my issues with the film is that I can never tell when Colin Farrell is trying to be creepy or when he just is creepy because he's Colin Farrell.
yeah, and it's a good look for him. Yeah,
yeah. Like I feel like if you were having like a beer with him and he just got like a little bit too bored, I feel like he'd let his face slip, and he has like resting murder face.
I love his presence. I just want to say that up front. I don't want to make it sound like I think he's a bad actor at all.
No. Oh my God. I love Colin Farrell. Like he's the greatest. I've liked him ever since I saw him in The War Zone, where he has like a basically wordless performance. Anyway, unimportant, but like, I just wanted to bring that up because like, part of my issue with this movie in general is that I'm not 100% sure of what I'm supposed to be getting from it at any point. One could say that in that way, the movie is, beguiling, because it's everything is very ambiguous. Everything is very uncertain and open to interpretation, until it's suddenly not, and everything kind of snaps into relief, but not in a way that's like, you know, Shyamalan Sixth Sense type of thing, where a new piece of information suddenly makes all of the Garrities make sense. It's more like everyone just suddenly swaps out all of this interesting humanity for a more direct villain and good guy scenario, which was deeply disappointing, because for the longest time, it seemed as though you had this man who was locked in a room and was dealing with people individually, and because he is a Union soldier in Virginia who is wounded and is a man amongst a bunch of women, he seemed to be using his masculine wiles to curry favor with everyone individually in order to kind of secure his place and his safety. But, and like, that's that's a great story, and I think seeing the way that the women interact with each other as time goes on is also interesting. But you never really kind of see... We never really get a sense of the women in this movie, like, letting their assumptions or their beliefs regarding their specific special relationship with him bump against everyone else's. There was a surprising lack of, like, intra-feminine conflict. Like, they kind of give each other crap about dressing up.
Sure.
But he never, like, causes them to sort of turn on each other.
Yeah, they snipe at each other, but they're never full on. There's a moment, especially towards the end of the film, where I thought it could have gone that direction, and it doesn't. And I was surprised by certain character motivations there, you know.
Yeah, and
a few people have noted that Coppola, throughout her career, has been kind of interesting in the sense that she doesn't allow women to literally to bicker with each other. But I understand completely where you're coming from.
Because it just it creates this sense of inertia. Because I could feel things changing between him and different women.
Sure.
But the house itself seemed to hold very much still.
And then the third act.
and then the third act happens and everything is different. Now, my wife, who is a woman, saw this movie and loved it and says it's her favorite of the year and had a lot to say about the way that it encompasses the way that women feel they have to present themselves to men and the way that you have to be very aware of the way that a man looks at you and thinks of you and be prepared for the blowback when his assumptions regarding your relationship or... you know, what the power dynamic is change, because that could be a problem that could lead to violence. And I find that to be interesting.
Sure.
But I feel like this movie, from my own personal standpoint, I guess not having that as an innate knowledge, because I am a man and I am, you know, 6'2" and very large, and I've never had to be, like, concerned about something like that. It would have been helpful for me to have more time to understand what happens when a relationship, you know, like in this movie, turns toxic in the way that it does, and to maybe not rush into the third act moments that to me felt like, oh, okay, so we're just burning it all down. But, like, you know, the cinematography is beautiful, and the first 3/4 of the film are like such a pure, devious delight to watch, just in the way that you constantly are, like, concerned about Colin Farrell and then about the women that he's talking with, because you can kind of feel everything preparing to go wrong. I just don't think that you're prepared for the way in which it's going to go wrong. And sure. I think that if you are really invested in the sort of social and intimacy dynamics that are going
sure.
on, the snapping into the final moments is going to be like a real jarring letdown for you.
I hate to bring her comments into this, but I do feel it's relevant to the conversation. So a few people have asked, you know, how she became familiar with this or where her interest came. And I believe it was her production designer who came to her and said, you know, there's this great movie from the 70s, except that the problem is that it doesn't have the female perspective. And there is something that is in the conversation about how she talks about this movie that it feels like it wants to be such a deliberate revision of the source material. And there is just something... there's something that honestly grinds my gears a little bit about that. Like desire to want to change things is, you know, as you're saying, Brian, like, there are characters here where you're supposed to get a lot from a from, you know, a simple expression or you know, motives are supposed to make sense because it's not about narrative logic. Like, it's an actively, stubbornly going against that. But it is just also, at some point, feels like an arbitrary change and something that kind of it misses the point a little bit. I don't know. I guess I'm getting into bad faith characterizations, but just combined with how she talks about her own movie mm-hmm. and the evidence on screen, I'd be very curious what a different cut of this movie would have been, even from Coppola, that wasn't, you know, an hour and 35 minutes.
So you're like, I'm assuming you'd want more.
Yes, that's what I mean.
Yeah, because like, here's my thing. When I walk into a movie that's like an hour and a half, I'm usually pretty psyched about it, just because some really great movies are very short, because mm-hmm. they know what they're saying, and they can kind of use mm-hmm. like scalpel-like precision to like cut right to the bone of their story. And so I was super excited for this, because I was like, this is an idea that if you drag it out too long could just become burdensome and annoying. And I was sure. interested to see like this. It's a very snappy, you know, concept for a film. And so I was excited to see how it would like parcel out its time. And then, you know, when the turn happens, it's like it's the bad kind of short movie where it really does sure. feel like, okay, suddenly now we've got things to do. And it kind of made me, for a moment, but no longer, because, you know, you gotta enjoy what you got. But it made me, for a while, resent the pastoral languidness mm. of the first three quarters, because I was like, sure. if we just cut out a couple yeah. scenes of people chopping or hoeing or pumping water, maybe we could have spent more time in this new reality and understood it more. But yeah, we keep talking about the end. Obviously, that's where most of our problems lie. So we should probably get into spoilers. So any non-spoiler thoughts before we do that? I will say that I had the beguiled moment yesterday when I live in D.C. and I stepped outside when the fireworks began, hoping that I could see some in the sky, even though I wasn't at any. But like, my entire house was surrounded by the noise of it. Like, any direction I turned, I could pick out a different, distinct fireworks display happening.
Sure.
And so I felt truly surrounded by explosions. And I was like, it's interesting that, you know, the given different contexts, like, I'm here standing in wonder. But, like, 200 years ago, this would have been terrifying.
Yeah.
Because something bad would have been happening.
Yeah, it was funny. My friends were talking about that recently, and we were talking about the bombs bursting over air and kind of like, you know, the song and everything like that. And now people shoot off fireworks for fun. And back then it was like, that was not fun. Like, those bombs were definitely bursting over the air. Like, that was not a fun situation for us. Like,
it's interesting. Well, it's like Halloween, you know, you dress up like a yeah. scary thing to celebrate, sure. you know, something different.
Sure.
Oh my god. Anyway, so let's get into spoilers for The Beguiled. Oh. I'm sorry, Mike, did you have a thing to say?
I was just going to say, you know, we keep talking about how beautiful and, like, you know, well acted and stuff this is. I do want to say, this movie's pretty funny. There's some scenes that are a real good time in this. You know, it may be related to an apple pie.
Oh, yes.
Oh, that's, oh my God. Yeah. Well, like, yeah. And all that is what I was kind of hoping for. And I wanted it sure. to escalate.
I wanted more of that for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's kind of one of the reasons why you might want to update a film like this, is to
sure.
add in a lot of kind of subtle touches like that, that a lot of us, a modern audience, you know, even with the, you know, like the whole idea of American Pie and like all of these other things that have all kind of led to that sequence being as funny as it is, there's so many other opportunities to kind of lay down verbiage or descriptions or things like that that would definitely make us, a modern audience, laugh that wouldn't have hit in 1971, you know?
Well, Coppola is kind of interesting in the sense of, like, you know, not only in terms of her camera movements and things, but there's like a weird present tense to everything she does. Like, you can actively, when characters do something at its best for me, like, it doesn't feel very scripted to me. Like, it could have literally been a spontaneous reaction in that moment. And that's what I think, like, absolutely, like, an upgrade really gets across. In terms of what you were talking about, Bill.
Yeah. And like, here's the thing is that more, I guess we're in spoilers now. Let's just say we're in spoilers.
Yes.
So, because I'm going to leapfrog off of what you all were talking about. So
sure.
I feel like with a movie like this, you want to begin at maybe like a 4 and then slowly crank it up to like a 10 or 11. And I feel like this movie gets up to like a 7 and then coasts. And then it's suddenly at 11. And so I feel like expanding upon that apple pie sniping and the way that the youngest girl like wears Kirsten Dunst's earrings and then they kind of like poke at each other. Like, I feel if we had just gone one or two steps up from that to like maybe some like saying it out loud. And maybe having Colin Farrell be there for it when the moment comes that he loses his leg and believes that it is a kind of punishment being visited upon him by a jealous person, then that would land more. As it stands,
this movie's a little bit afraid of camp. Like, it seems a little bit afraid that they're going to undermine their characters if they do go into, like, you know, like a more extreme thing. Like what you're talking about, the earrings. Like, if it did go, you know, if it went into Verhoeven territory, which is personally what I love.
Oh, my God. But like, now all I want in the world is a Verhoeven version of The Beguiled.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying.
It's strange because...
That's what it's about.
Yeah, and it seems to be, like, afraid of that. And but, like, then it becomes, like, if you're to look at it the way that that my wife does, which is, I think it's a valid opinion that the movie could be read that way, then it makes some sense. But I just have a problem that for the longest time it holds on to this... kind of like he is the reactive element and the women are the real core of the story, and it's all about how their relationships kind of alter and change.
Sure.
And then suddenly it's about Colin Farrell hobbling around without a leg with a gun, throwing turtles and shouting at people and getting drunk.
But it's not only Colin Farrell that's like a little bit ruined there. Like, even Al Fanning's character kind of loses, like, you know, after she is caught having sex, and from that moment on, like, she's no longer like this interesting like force.
She isn't, because at the end, especially in that final kind of dinner sequence, there is a moment where you feel like she may say something, because she's in on the plan. She understands that this man is about to die.
Well, that's, and like, why
she doesn't say anything. And I was just waiting and waiting, because if that had happened, we can imagine where this film may go from that point on. Maybe he eats a couple of them, but not enough, things like that, and they have to take over. Instead, it becomes very clean in a way where they're able to save Kiki, they're able to save like all of these people, and he just flat out dies and he can't threaten them at all.
Did you say Kiki? You know?
Yes, that is her nickname.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm distracted now from what I was going to say.
I just like we come up with nicknames for people on this all the time, like Mikey Fass, Terry.
Why not for women? Why not for women?
Well, Kiki is just like, it's too far removed. Like, if you'd said like Kurdunst, I'd been like, oh, okay.
Kay Dunst.
Nikki Kidd. Like, you know, get like Nikki Kidd.
The impropriety.
Elfan.
Stop. Stop. You're killing Michael. Michael's going to die.
Just think of what it'll be like when I come up with one for Una Lawrence. Because her name is already Una. So.
Yes. Yeah.
But so like yeah, my issue kind of becomes that you have him kind of splitting these women apart. Nicole Kidman obviously is interested in him, and they have a little flirtation going on. Then there's Edwina, who he really does seem to like latch on to her, like he doesn't
very heavily.
He doesn't really lead Miss Martha on, but like he's talking about running away with Edwina really hard, and. Sure, like Elle Fanning is there being Elle Fanning, but
I mean she like kisses him on the lips with, you know,
out of nowhere, like I mean, just like, because.
Well, it's because they're Elle Fanning and Colin Farrell, you know.
Sure,
like, you got those two people in a house together. I'd be disappointed if they didn't make out.
I did like that. That stuff does feel like Sofia Coppola is in the right place.
Yeah,
like there's not a jump there.
Yeah, like, I want more of that.
Yeah,
like I want more of that to happen to lay the groundwork for what ends up happening towards the end. That way I can kind of feel satisfied about A, his death, but B, just where this film narratively goes.
And like so he's like part of this is like maybe he is supposed to be like a slightly drunk idiot at this point. But like I have trouble with like the fact that he would ask Edwina to come and see her and then go see Elle Fanning. Go see Alicia. And
I and that's the big kind of crux of this. I'm not sure. I don't want to get into spoilers for the original, but I'm not sure whether the film or the book really does that kind of that trick. Where all of a sudden, even we as an audience don't understand why he's necessarily making that jump. And this is one of those things where character perspective becomes very important, because we get that sequence happening from Kirsten Dunst's perspective. We don't get it from Elle Fanning's perspective. And I think Elle Fanning's perspective in that moment would have been so much more interesting to see what she did to basically lure him into her bed. Yes, instead of Kirsten Dunst, who he's already kind of professed his love for. And it seems like, okay, this seems like a coupling that would make sense. And that even like the sequence, what I love so much about it is you can see it from Kirsten Dunst and you can see that she's preparing herself. In a lot of ways, she's brushing her hair out. She's got this beautiful kind of gown on, and it's like,
putting up
okay,
him.
Yeah, she's expecting him to drop by that night, or just be prepared for whatever, right?
My other thing is like, if they were just like, hey, you're just gonna stay here now, I could more understand him just like picking one at random, but like. They make a show of the fact that like they're gonna ask him to leave and he's got to do something to secure his place there.
Sure.
Yes.
And so,
like he's got to wiggle his way into their kind of hearts and minds.
Right.
And the easiest way for that to happen is to marry one of those women and not to piss all of them off. Right.
So he could either get with Miss Martha, in which case she's the headmistress and she'll keep him around, or. He could get with Edwina because apparently her father has like a shipping business in Richmond and can help him out.
Sure.
Like the only one who is of appropriate age who he stands to gain nothing from is Elle Fanning.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know super little about her, but it appears that she has no power in any capacity. So like it for me, like when this was all ramping up, I was expecting that like, because he and Miss Martha have a moment before this happens. And so I was expecting him to go to Kirsten Dunst and Nicole Kidman to find them. And then that to be the inciting incident. But instead, he does this incredibly stupid thing, which, I mean, you could, again, you could chalk it up to this guy's thinking with his dick, but, like, I feel like with the danger of being put out on the road, that is less likely, and it becomes less of an acceptable narrative reason.
Yeah, the way he talks with Nicole Kidman, they have the sequence in the garden where he's no longer kind of hobbling around.
Sure.
He's still kind of a little bit immobile, but she has this sequence where she's talking about like putting him out, and he's like, it's a shame I wasn't able to be hobbled a little bit longer, you know? And it's like, man, he's got the absolute perspective on this that, yes, they did him a incredible kindness, but now it just seems so mean. They've gotten to know him.
Sure.
They've gotten to kind of, you know, understand him a little bit. At first, I understand he is kind of this monster, right? He's this thing that shouldn't be there. But slowly, he's starting to work his way into their hearts. And as soon as that happens, he's got to go, you know? And so from his perspective, he thinks, man, this sucks because those sure. guys are not going to treat me very well. They're probably going to kill me, mm-hmm. right? They can't take prisoners. Mm-hmm. And so all of these other things start to kind of go through his head. And he's right, you know, in a way they did him a kindness, but they're not doing him an ultimate kindness, right?
And
they're like,
now this is not to excuse his, I just want to throw this out there. This is not to excuse him like getting a gun and threatening their lives.
Oh, hell no. Hell
he becomes yeah. 100% truly monstrous. But
sure.
again, I feel like his leap to you cut off my leg to spite me.
Is
a bit much. It doesn't.
Can we talk about this briefly? Because the internet's actually been having a lot of conversations. Did you guys see anything that would lead you to believe that Martha is malicious in cutting his leg off?
No.
Martha's Nicole Kidman, right?
Miss Farnsworth.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry.
No, there's like she very clearly is trying to rescue him. You can like I've seen some broken bones that look real bad. That looked real, real bad. Like, whoa.
I have seen a female rugby player with a compound fracture and mm-hmm. like Oof. She was rushed to the hospital because that's what you've got to do with those. And I really don't know what these people would have done with this man if they didn't
sure.
cut his leg off. I mean, he already had a bad leg, and then to have that happen, like, yeah, I don't expect her to be like, oh, I can set this.
Yeah.
You know, spoiler alert for the book, a separate piece, but if you do that poorly, you can kill someone. So, yes. Like, if I were out in the woods with a friend, I would probably, and they broke their leg that way, I would probably say, like, hey, man, you got to tell me what you want, because right now I'm thinking cutting it off is the best idea.
Yes.
But yeah, like, no, there's, it's not like we don't see the leg. It's not like she looks from girl to girl and is like, you know, you fucking young-ass saucy broads, I'm gonna take all of this away from you. Like, she seems genuinely concerned, and his leg looks super terrible, like real yeah. bad, and and she's not like she's not yeah. just doing this like I hate this guy, I'm just gonna take
yeah,
it off like
it.
she seems to be putting effort in, you know, and if she was being spiteful, I think she could just hack through it and hope for the best.
I want to mention one thing real quick, just a funny point. It looks like half of her work is already done for her based on that leg. Like I'm looking at that. I'm like, okay, so we're halfway there. All right, let's
it's
go.
Like the difference between extracting a tooth and taking a loose tooth out of a child's mouth.
Yes. Yes.
Like I don't have to do nothing. Like I just got to pull a little harder than usual. Like, are you ready?
No,
for this?
I just got to flick it. I just yeah. got to flick it, man.
Oh.
Like, man, that leg
to
was
tie this to a doorknob.
Yeah, that was ready to go. That was ready to go.
Michael, you brought this up. Did you find anything malicious, or have other people found maliciousness?
No. A lot of people have. Well, so you guys have not seen the original?
I have not.
No.
Yeah, do you want me to say anything about it that would potentially serve as a contrast?
I mean, sort of, because I'm interested, but at the same time, I don't know how it would affect my reading of this film. But
fair enough. I will hold off, but I will say that watching that other movie made this a far more productive and interesting experience for me, but also probably blinded me to a few things, because the other one has things that that appeal far more to my own sensibility. So like,
okay, interesting. But yeah, I mean, and then at that point, obviously he's upset, you know, he's lost his leg, and it's kind of weird because he, and this is another thing, you know, there's the movie and the book Atonement, where, sure. I don't know if you listen.
I guess
at home,
spoilers for
it.
That.
This isn't really spoilers, but like, okay. The whole conflict of Atonement is that there's a young girl who has feelings for a boy, and the boy is older than her and has feelings for her older sister, and those feelings between everyone create a situation wherein someone misinterprets, either maliciously or accidentally, a situation that harms someone else. And like, I was expecting more of that in this. I was expecting Una Lawrence, who not Una Lawrence, and Gori Rice, who plays Jane, who is a musician and who seems to be very much of the cause of the South. I was expecting her to like wait for a moment to fuck Colin Farrell over, because she is all about hating on the Union. I was expecting Una Lawrence, who looks at him in almost a fatherly way, to become distressed because he is like taking advantage of people that she views as her sisters or something. But instead we get him threatening Elle Fanning into getting the gun, and like, but that never really comes back on Elle. Like, no one sits there and says like, how the fuck did he get that gun? And then Elle Fanning has to be like, well, you know, we were kind of carrying on, and I got it for him. And then everyone would be like, well, why would you do that crazy thing? And then maybe they'd turn on her, and then she'd be on his side, or then, like, there's so many opportunities for not twists so much, but just, like, the various interpersonal reactions and interactions that I was expecting. None of them came to pass.
It would require the women to turn on each other, which feels like this movie does everything possible not to do that.
Yeah.
It's interesting. And the other thing that I found kind of curious was a lot of the interactions that happen in this film happen specifically with like Colin Farrell, that happen outside of the gaze of the other women, is because for some godforsaken reason, the key is suddenly left in the lock instead of always gone. Like,
sure.
Very noticeably at the beginning of this film, they literally lock the door and nobody can come inside. They lock the door, they lock the door, they lock the door, and all of a sudden the door has the key inside of it. It's locked from the inside, right? Or from the outside.
Sure.
But they can still come and go as they please. And a lot of the interactions here start to become issues because of that specific situation that has happened. And I don't necessarily feel like it's gotten to that point. By the time like Elle Fanning kisses him, I don't think that sequence necessarily happens in a time period where Nicole Kidman and specifically her, because she's kind of the watchdog of the entire group.
She's the key man.
She hasn't relinquished and like let him feel at home in this place. I can't remember at what point. I think it's actually maybe even later that night where she actually shares a drink with him. But it's one of those sequences where I don't understand, because she's so icy to him throughout the film. I don't understand why she's suddenly like, oh yeah, let me just leave that key in there. Like, no big deal now. Like, that's a terrible idea.
You know, Michael, like you said, like they never really have the women turn on each other. But like, Elle Fanning, by giving him that gun, like,
I know,
what do you think is gonna happen? Like, And then, you know, he busts into the kitchen and is like waving the gun around and drinks some whiskey and then smashes the bottle. But then after that is a weird moment where like he actually is like with them in a parlor and.
Yeah, I was just thinking about this.
And he actually gives like a speech that like shows his point of view. And
what's the word he uses to describe himself? He's like, I lost it. I didn't lose it a little bit. He uses a word that like drastically underdefines how bonkers he was.
Yeah.
Like now, in that scene.
To be fair, he appears to be drunk and in a great amount of pain, and he's lost his leg, and like there's a lot happening. But like I feel like I don't know, there's an emotional realism in the first part of the film that kind of like leaves it after that happens. And it's, you know, like I said, like he throws a turtle.
Yeah,
I have a lot of. I don't know why that's like stuck in my craw so much, but it just feels like
it's the
easiest thing to have him do to drive away like the one person who
seems
to even have at that pure point, feelings for him, like just like loved him as a person and like I said, as kind of a father figure. And
I keep going back and forth whether there should be an insert shot or whether it's more effective without one of the turtle
like skittering across the floor.
Yeah, no, or something, because it is treated like nothing. Like it's not even
cut. About whether or not that turtle lives.
Yes, I am too. Yeah, I'm with you, Brian. Like that sequence in particular, I feel like, because even he kind of likes that little girl, at least from what I can tell. So much of his interactions were so nice with her and everything like that. And
he literally calls her his best friend in the entire place.
And the way he says it, you're right, Brian. I can't tell if he's saying it in a creepy way or if he's saying it out of genuine affection for her.
The thing is, like, you know, he's like standing behind Elle Fanning at one point and looking at her, and I'm like, all right, Big Bad Wolf, like, calm down. But like, all of his time with Amy, Una Lawrence's character with the turtle, is like. I never felt any weirdness. Like it was constantly like just this very warm paternal thing. And like you could almost imagine like a Disney Channel movie about like this little Confederate girl who rescues a Union soldier and like he helps her to save the farm or something. But like, you know, obviously this movie is not going to be that. But it just feels weird that like they have to turn her against him, and the easiest way to do that is for him to toss her turtle, which is not a euphemism. And
it is a little extra weird too that we have a couple characters here who show up at the beginning and then kind of disappear despite being in all of these scenes. I mean, things like you mentioned Angry Rice and Emma Howard, like they are two characters there who like the movie only wants to acknowledge they exist when it like increases tension or something. And it's a little bit odd when they are in most of the scenes where things actually happen.
Right. And like, again, I don't have as much problem with Angouri Rice but I think that there was more there for that too. Like you could kind of feel her initially kind of hating the core of him and then slowly warming to him.
Sure.
And I feel like that would be another like level, another thing. Like, you know, you feel this girl's affections shifting, even not towards romance, but just like being cool with him. And you know, that would be another source of tension. You know, I literally don't remember anything that Emma Howard as Emily did. Marie, who is played by Addison Reek, I guess. She has that great interaction with Kirsten Dunst,
and
she's also the one who comes up with the mushroom idea. So it's okay. I need to know if this is a problem for anyone else. My wife and I both thought initially that girl was Mercy from The Witch.
Yes. Yeah. I understand where
she
you're getting
not,
at.
But like,
no.
I swore it was that actress. And part of me now that I'm thinking about it is wondering if it's because she is mean to an older sister surrogate and then also like murders someone. But yeah. Yeah, that's, I like, I, it's just, it's kind of weird because, like I said, the movie is so strong for so long, and then it feels like it gives up on the best parts of itself at the end for this ending that it decides on.
Yeah. Even that, like, literal last shot, I kind of feel like is a little bit of a squib. Like, there's just something kind of, I was just kind of annoyed that we had a tracking shot that lingers so long without actually telling me anything at all. Like, there's just something a little bit like, there's some like art house pretensions to this that feels so out of place.
That actually made me think of that thing that you said where it's like, you could kind of tell what was happening. Like you talked about during the It Comes at Night podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, this is the last shot. And it's just so old.
Yep. And even though one character is out of frame and weirdly obscured by the fence or grate or whatever that thing is. Yeah. And I was just like, really, this is your last shot? This is your big like boom moment? Okay.
Well, I mean, I guess the one last thing I want to talk about before we wrap up, because we should wrap up, is
so, you guys need to watch the Seagull one. I'm serious. I really think you guys get different perspectives.
Among the seven other films we need to see in the next two weeks.
Coming soon. The Big Sick.
Spider-Man.
Valerian.
The Apes.
Do we have to watch Valerian?
I want to. So
I want to see Valerian.
God, I want to fucking blow my brain out.
Rihanna.
All right, anyway, so what I was going to say is the final interaction between him and Kirsten Dunst, like, do we think that she's just trying to pacify him, or is she actually like, this is my chance?
This is my chance.
Okay.
I had
like real questions about that, because then like at the end, she seems like, oh, you kill, like, he is not a good man. He makes a lot of poor choices and does a lot of horrible, selfish things, whether any of them deserve murder is up for debate. Because I'm murder. I'm an old school kind of guy. Sometimes someone just needs killing, you know? Like, I get behind that every now and then, especially in movies when I don't have to do it. But like, it just feels like it wouldn't be out of character for one of these people to speak up and be like, hey, we killed a guy and I don't know that he deserved it. You know,
it is the power dynamic that he displayed, which is the biggest issue. And when he's missing a leg, but he also can physically overpower each and every one of them in a lot of ways.
Right. So it is, you know, like you said, it's the power dynamic. Like if you're not
gonna... and he revealed that he didn't have to play that card. Right. And I think this is kind of what your wife is kind of touching upon in a lot of ways, is when a lot of males and females interact, and, you know, you can see coupling between, you know, people of the same sex, and I can imagine that coupling is significantly different because there isn't often, I mean, sometimes there is, but there isn't often a extreme power dynamic where it becomes very obvious that in intimate situations, one person could clearly overpower another if they wanted to get out of that situation, right? Mm-hmm. When a male and a female kind of are starting to court each other and things like that, I think oftentimes the male is usually taller. And the female is usually the smaller of the two, not just, you know, in stature, but just in just about every way. And he plays that card that in any interaction with a female, you should never, ever, ever play, right? And when he plays it with the gun in hand as well, it scares the shit out of all of them. You know, all of a sudden it becomes very clear he wasn't a threat necessarily. He didn't have to play that card. Once he plays that card, he cannot put that card back away. It never goes away from that point forward. And so he threatened violence against them physically. He threw a fucking turtle. Like this guy, bad news. And he put himself in that position to basically give them one single option, and that is to kill him, unfortunately. I think his death here is justified just by that alone, okay. because he wasn't giving them an out. He wasn't saying, hey, I'm going to disappear, I'm going to leave, or anything like that. He was very much like, okay, I guess I'm here now.
And that's another thing that I just kind of didn't really understand. Like, why he was like, I'm just going to hang and, like, yeah. just, you know, what are your options? Like, the country's at war, you have lost a leg, but, like...
He underestimates them,
though.
Sometimes
you just got to extricate yourself from a bad situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That he caused. Yeah.
But isn't that a little bit the point, in the sense that he does underestimate them, and he does think at any point... I mean, I guess from where the movie goes, you're supposed to kind of think that he's trying to always get one over on these people. Like, there is a way that you can retroactively interpret it. I think it makes the movie, honestly, less interesting. Mm-hmm. But, like, there is something to be said that, like, the whole point of this movie is kind of, like, that weird tension between whether the girl should keep him, at having, you know, heard terrible things about women being, you know... sexually abused and things like that by Union soldiers. And so there's like that constant fear of men, but also, you know, having someone in their clutches. But but there is just something so weird about that, because this is a movie that is inherently about power dynamics without actually wanting to indulge in any of the power. Like, even where characters have to, like, make a choice or do something, like, it doesn't really follow through. I don't know.
It's troubling. The last third of this film are just kind of, they feel like just a whiff on so many different levels. They really do. And I think Brian was kind of perfect in the way that he summed it up was, it kind of hits a 7, it cruises, and then it hits an 11, and you're just like, whoa, okay, I guess we're here now, you know. And it's not just with, like, the mood and the tension, it's with that, sure. with like all of the character portrayals and things like that. We're skipping a step, and we never see that kind of jump and leap that's usually so satisfying, you know. For a lot of these movies, it's that ratcheting up continually, not a ratchet and then hold and then boom, let's just break the whole fucking thing, you know. Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay. Well, that seems like a good place to end, with me being told that my, you know, analogy was perfect. So, yes, let me remind everyone to give to us directly at patreon.com/thefilmstageshow for as little as $1 per episode. You will get access to our Slack channel. You will get put into different raffles and stuff that we hold for cool movie shit. And... of course, you will help us to create different, newer, better, interesting episodes of this show. Also, we are brought to you by MUBI, the streaming online cinema. I didn't even say where you go. Patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. We're also brought to you by MUBI, the streaming online cinema. MUBI, you can use it on your phone. You can use it on your Roku. You can use it on your... I don't know, like, literally everything, it feels like. And MUBI, I will say this again, has one of the nicest looking apps. Video streaming apps are almost uniformly terrible, but MUBI's is quite beautiful and really helps to highlight what they have, so you never have trouble finding the perfect film to watch. For your free 30-day trial of MUBI, go to mubi.com/filmstage, and you will get that free 30-day trial on us. All right. This weekend, I believe we are talking about Spider-Man Homecoming. Is that right? The Big Sick, maybe, too? I don't know.
Yes. Yes. Potentially both of those.
One or both of those movies. So
That Entertainment Weekly cover is almost a deal breaker for me.
Yes. You know, but like the movie.
Like, I'm going to see. I'm going to see both of those films, like, regardless. Sure. And yeah. I'm probably going to see them within the next, you know, 3 to 4 days. So, woo!
Woo! All right. Well, we will be back with those reviews when the time allows. So look forward to that. In the meantime, let's tell you where we can be found between now and then. Michael Snydell.
Oh, shit.
All right. Never mind. Bill Graham.
You can find me on Twitter at CableBFG. You can find me writing about movies on The Film Stage and FreshFiction.tv. But you can most definitely find me, I guess, in a theater for the next 3 weeks.
And Michael Snydell.
You can find me on Twitter at Snydell, where sometimes I like the movies we talk about on the podcast. And you can find my writing on the Film Stage and Letterboxd. I know I've been a little light on writing lately. Maybe that'll change soon.
All right. Yeah, I've been watching more movies recently. I had a mini Christopher Nolan, Christopher Nolan Film Festival at my house the other day, watching some of his earlier work. And I actually just watched this movie again that I saw a while ago called Below. It's like a ghost story that takes place in World War II sub. So check out my ratings for those over at Letterboxd at Brian J. Rowan. My Twitter's at Brian J. Rowan. And yeah, you can find my writing at thefilmstage.com and my personal site, dearfilm.net. So ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. And tune in next time.